Session number 12439, Major John Sim, Reel 1.
Could we start by your telling me where you were born, please?
Yes, I was born out in Persia, up in the hills, in 1920. My father was a regular soldier in the 2nd Battalion, York and Lancaster Regiment, and my mother was following the drum, as wives used to in those days. And I was told that I was born in a marquee tent up in the wilds. The battalion, with the brigade group after the war, First Great War, was up in northern Persia, keeping an eye on the Russians for fear of them sweeping down to the Persian Gulf.
So where were you educated?
I was educated at a prep school at Ashdown House near Forest Row in Sussex. And then I went to Cheltenham College.
Did you go from Cheltenham to Sandhurst?
Yes. I passed into Sandhurst in August 1939 as the last group of gentlemen cadets going into Sandhurst.
What was the course like in...
Well, we were barely there for a fortnight. We arrived at Sandhurst in August 39, and a fortnight later, war was declared. And the whole of the regular gentlemen cadets course at Sandhurst was upset tremendously. The regular officers and many of the NCOs and sergeants of on the staff were disappeared back to their regiments. And our course was rapidly changed to a rushed course, like a nocturne later. We were only there under the instructions of the guard sergeant majors remained, so we had a good bashing on the parade ground. But our teachers were officers from OTC schools who came in to teach us, and they knew as little about soldiering as we did, virtually. So, but anyway, at the end of the year, we were all given a regular commission, and the War Office very kindly said that it was our intention to become regular officers. We'd passed an exam into Sandhurst, and that unless we had blotted our copybook badly, we would have ended as with a regular commission. So they gave us all a regular commission. And I joined my father's regiment at the depot at Pontefract in Yorkshire.
What was your father's regiment?
York and Lancaster Regiment.
I think that in 1940 you went to Iceland.
Yes, well, there were a few regular young officers in the depot at the time, and we just couldn't get ourselves on a draft to go overseas to the Middle East or the Far East to join one of our battalions out there. We were retained in England to train the militia who were sweeping in. But eventually I managed to get myself on a large draft of 5 officers and 120 men, OC the draft, and without knowing where in the hell we were going, we left England from Greenock on the Georgic, and to our surprise, when we sailing north of Ireland, instead of the ship sailing south, we sailed northwards, and we were told, and we weren't told until then, that we were going to Iceland. And then I found out that apparently after we had been kicked out of Norway by the Germans, the 49th Div, which was a territorial division around Yorkshire and the north, were reasonably intact from Norway, and they were only the division available in England to be whipped elsewhere. And the War Office whipped the 49th Div to Iceland. In that division was the TA Battalion of the York and Lancaster Regiment, which was the Hallamshire Battalion from Sheffield. And so we were a draft to reinforce our TA Battalion in Iceland in the 49th Div. We landed at Reykjavik, and then we put onto a little small coaster, and the coaster whipped us up to the north of Iceland to a place called Akureyri, where the battalion was established.
Under what conditions?
Well, it was very, very cold. We were under canvas. I arrived at about May, June 1940, and the battalion was scattered in the northern fjords of Iceland in company detachments, guarding a little herring factory in little fjords along the coastline. Of course, the aim of that, of the Division 49th Div, was to deny to the enemy the facilities of the fjords for their submarines and airfields, which they would have used to strike at the Atlantic convoys. I heard later that we only just got there in time, that the Germans had indeed planned after Norway to establish themselves in Iceland. And if they had done that, we'd have lost the Battle of the Atlantic and England would have been starved.
What was the attitude of the Icelandic civilians to your presence?
Well, to start with, they weren't very happy to see us because they had been softened up by the Germans before the war, the Germans sending around the world their health through joy ships, as they called them, where they landed their civilian passengers in various ports to make friends with the populace there. And the Germans and the Icelanders became very friendly with the Germans because of that. And so our soldiers were sort of jeered at and spat at and Heil Hitler'd at when they were on duty as a sentry on the harbour wall or something like that. But we told our soldiers just to ignore this attitude and just play it cool, so to speak. And we were there in the same place for 2 years, 2.5 years. There was no leave. There was no chance of volunteering to go elsewhere. We just had to, because there wasn't the shipping to allow us to volunteer to join paras or commandos or another unit. So we were literally stuck in northern Iceland for two and a bit years.
Did the Icelanders actually show hostility to you, or was it just a cold shoulder?
Only a cold shoulder to begin with. But then eventually, after 2 years had elapsed, we were so scattered along the coast that we didn't really fraternize. We didn't have the chance to fraternize with the Icelanders. A reasonable town in our area was Akureyri, which was just a fishing town. Eventually, we got Nissen huts to live in, and we've pretty well built our own camp. We met and constructed the Nissen huts ourselves. There weren't the sappers to construct all the huts for everyone, so we did it ourselves. The only thing we couldn't do was to cut the glass for the windows, because we hadn't got the diamond cutters. But we were kept very busy, and of course we were very fit. We had to keep our soldiers busy. We created a little football ground in the rough area around our camp, and we rushed around the mountains. I commanded the battalion ski platoon. The War Office sent us skis and the like, and snowshoes and the like, which they had gathered before war started, as we intended to send a force to Finland at the beginning of the war, to help Finland fight the Russians. And we were going to send an expeditionary force out there, and the War Office had gathered a lot of skis and the like from civilian tourists around. They were asked if they could surrender their winter equipment to the War Office. So we received this lot, and instead of using them for recreational purposes, we established a ski platoon per battalion.
Did the Icelanders become more welcoming as time went by?
Yes, they began to accept us, and they were quite normal. I only managed to get into Akureyri to do a bit of shopping about so half a dozen times, hardly that. But surprisingly enough, about middle of 1942, they got the rumor first that the Americans were going to come and establish themselves in Iceland and relieve the British. And we were asked about this, and we said we know nothing about this. And they didn't want this to happen. They'd got used to us, the British, there, and they didn't fancy the Americans coming in at all. But it happened. It was wonderful, really. I was up in the mountains with my platoon doing exercises. We were extremely fit running around the mountains. When down below at the fjord, long way down below us, we saw this wonderful sight of a big troop ship, double funnel, sailing quietly and majestically down the fjord to Akureyri. And it transpired that this ship was full of American soldiers. And they came and relieved us of our camp. And within about 48 hours, two or three days, we were on that ship sailing home to England.
What kind of impression did the American soldiers make when they landed?
I don't know. We went there to see it, but they were quite a mob. I mean, a company came into our company camp, and they were from the hottest part of America, I think South Carolina or somewhere, you know, where it was 110 in the shade. They didn't seem to have any administrative gear at all. We left there. They didn't have anything like soap or toilet paper or anything. They didn't have any drivers to take over our four vehicles. One heard the officer on parade saying, "Say, you guys, we've got four vehicles to take over, three tonners and one jeep. Any of you guys know how to drive?" And nobody did. "Any of you guys know would like to drive?" And about four or five hands went up, and that's how we left them.
Whilst you were there, had you had any morale problems with the troops?
No. No, we hadn't. We were a happy lot, I think mainly because we kept ourselves so busy. You see, the officers were amongst the men all the time. We had no girlfriends, we had no weekend leaves. We were there with them all the time to go out on exercise. There's some pretty good exercises arranged by brigade and the like, and company exercises up in the mountains, and battalion exercises, and a brigade one once a year. And we had letters from home. That's all, and we wrote letters home. And of course, we had to just stick it out and listen to the news of our cities being blasted by the Germans.
Did the Germans launch any attacks on?
No, we only had one alert when the Bismarck left the Norwegian fjord area and came into the Atlantic via Iceland. And we thought that this was going to be an invasion of Iceland, so there was a little bit of a flurry. But it transpired it was only the Bismarck getting into the Atlantic.
Did any of the soldiers marry Icelanders?
Later, after the war, I think. Yes, I think one or two who happened to be stationed near Akureyri. I think the Lincolns were stationed near Akureyri, and there were one or two. I know of one officer who married an Icelandic girl. But we didn't really get to know other battalions at all. We ourselves, our battalion was covering an area of 80 square miles along the coast. It took me a year and a half to get to know or to see all the officers of the battalion.
Now, how did you come to join the parachute battalion?
Right, then we came back to England, and because we were a highly trained mountain and snow warfare division, the 49th Division, and our badge on our arm was the polar bear, which we were very proud of, we carried on our mountain training in the Welsh area, and battalions, the whole division, the battalions were scattered in houses in Hereford, Leinster, Ludlow, Ross-on-Wye, all in that area. Our battalion, the Hallamshire Battalion, the York and Lancashire Regiment, were stationed at Leinster. And we were near the Welsh Mountains. So we kept fit and a little bit of mountain training in that area. And we were very happy to do so because we were proud of our fitness and our experience of mountain and snow warfare. But then as we were, and we thought that the day would come when we would be landed in Norway with the 52nd Division, which was the Scottish Division in Scotland, and they were also being trained at Mountainside Warfare. So there were two such divisions in England, a potential threat to Norway and the Germans to Norway. And that's where we thought the second bit of the second front would be. But then, at the last minute almost, sort of in 43, we came back in September, about September 42, to Leinster. And then about middle of 43, the War Office decided that the second front was not going to be Norway, and that it was a waste to have two mountain and snow warfare divisions carrying on with that their training. And so the 49th Division was changed. The task of it was changed to that of sea landings on the coast of France or wherever it was going to be. And so we had to forget about mountain snow warfare and start from scratch to train in landing on shores in assault landing craft. And from Leinster, we were whipped up to Scotland, to Crieff. Battalion was in Crieff Hydro. And we trained on the locks there, Lock Erne and others, on assault craft landings. And then many of us were extremely disappointed that our role had been changed. And we fancied doing something a little bit more exciting than just training from scratch in a division to learn something new from scratch. So we volunteered, and I volunteered, to join the parachute regiment. And a number did, and a number went to commandos too. So that was the time when I volunteered. I had been married. I married in 1943 in June, and it was quite evident in the papers that wherever the Second Front was going to be, it was going to be preceded at night by airborne divisions landing behind the enemy lines, behind Hitler's Western Wall, in mass. There were already two American airborne divisions building up in England. There was our British 1st Airborne Division out in Africa building up there, and a newly forming 6th Airborne Division building up in the Salisbury Plain area. So I approached my wife and I said, "Look, love, I think I'll have a better chance to land. I'm involved in going to the Second Front, and I don't fancy going by sea in an assault landing craft, having been thoroughly seasick for a couple of days and getting across the channel, and landing against this tremendous fortification on the beaches that Hitler had built up, and Rommel. Tremendous. I'd been on a course for officers learning about the German army and the Western Wall, and we all saw on this course the tremendous obstacles on the beaches. So I told my wife that I'd reckon I'd have a better chance of landing in France or wherever we're going by air at night, with the element of speed and surprise, with hundreds of your own friends around you, nothing clandestine, and occupying positions before dawn, and then of our own choosing, and then have the enemy coming to try and find us in the open. And getting slaughtered whilst they were doing it, perhaps. I'd have a better chance of survival if I went into the Second Front that way. And she pondered a while and thought that was okay. So she allowed me to volunteer for the parachute regiment, and this is what I did. And from Crieff, I was called up to report to Hardwick Hall, which was where the parachute regiment was sorting out its volunteers. We call it P Company now. And I think we spent a fortnight there, being really bashed around the place by the parachute sergeants, right, to prove our worth, that we were worthy to be accepted into the parachute regiment. Having done that course, we then, as a group, went to Ringway, which was where the parachute training took place, a parachute training school. And that was a joy, because having been flogged physically on assault courses and all that at Hardwick by extremely tough sergeants and NCOs and shouted at and yelled at, we then came into a different atmosphere of instruction completely. The RAF training instructors were very good indeed, and they quietly put us through our training in the hangars there. And they got us mentally geared up to jump out of a hole in a basket from below the balloon, or jump through a hole in the floor of an aircraft. Psychologically, they got us trained in a very almost gentlemanly sort of way, with a tremendous amount of humour and jokes. Quite a few failed. Those who couldn't accept heights and were afraid, they were sorted out in pretty quick time, not only at Hardwick but also at Ringway. But the bulk of us got through all right. And in those days, parachuting from obsolescent aircraft like the Whitley was quite a dicey thing. It was something new. It was a rejected, Whitley was a rejected bomber from Bomber Command. They didn't want to use anymore. So the army grabbed it and they experimented with it and bore a hole in the floor, with five parachutes sitting on the floor on one side of the hole and five on the other. And one went through the hole from side to side. and one had to do a gymnastic little flip from sitting on the edge of the hole to go through centrally. If you push too hard, you hit your face against the other side of the hole, and that was called ringing the bell. And if you didn't push hard enough, your parachute pack caught the back of the hole and tipped you forward to ring the bell again, so you had to be absolutely exact. And because the hole was quite close to the engines, you got the slipstream catching you when your body was halfway out of the hole. So as often as not, you were somersaulting out and catching your legs in the rigging lines of the parachute as it was open. Quite a number found themselves upside down with a foot tangled up in the rigging line. So that had to be sorted out on the way down. Or with a lot of twists in one rigging line, like you do with some kids on a swing, twist them around. We'd have a lot of twists. But anyway, the RAF taught us how to deal with these snags, so to speak, and we had a drill of what to do in the aircraft prior to the jumping through the hole, and what we had to do in the air if we had twists or were caught up, and avoiding action so we didn't collide into each other, and how to land safely. And all this drill was done, was given to us at Ringway. Well, in those days, the army wanted the volunteer to parachute, regardless of what unit he was from, whether he was an anti-tank man or RASC dispatch driver or a gunner or anything like that. They wanted men to volunteer to parachute. And so we had soldiers going through the parachute training from all arms. But after our parachute training was over, we were grouped together and we were drafted out to join a newly forming parachute battalion in the Salisbury Plain area. We sorted them out into counties, if possible, so that the Yorkshire lads went to a newly forming Yorkshire battalion at Lark Hill. The Lancashire lads, no matter what regiment they come from, went to the 13th Battalion. And anyone from the light infantry went to the 7th Battalion. And the 8th Battalion had home counties. So when we joined a battalion that was just being formed, we had a tremendous spirit, and not only was everyone had something in common in that we parachuted and done our course in Hardwick and Hardwick and had parachuted at Ringway, but we also had a county element involved, which built up a tremendous esprit de corps. But it meant that a lot of our soldiers, when I was going through Hardwick, I was, after going through tunnels and absolutely filthy and muddy and crawling through mud, I was called to the commandant's office to be interviewed straight away. So in this awful muddy condition, I went into his office and saluted, and there was a colonel there who said that he was from the 12th, he was a CO of the 12th Yorkshire Parachute Battalion. He was up here to recruit Yorkshiremen. He saw that I'd come from a Yorkshire regiment and asked me if I'd like to join his battalion. So I said, yes, sir. This was Colonel Reggie Parker. So I would very much. So that is what happened. Having passed my parachute course, I turned up at Lark Hill to the 12th Yorkshire Parachute Battalion. And I found that this battalion had been formed from the 10th Green Howards. There was a yeomanry battalion, and they had apparently been told by the War Office, like the other battalions, the 13th Lancashires, but the 10th Green Howards were told, right, we want to form a parachute battalion on you, ask for volunteers. And I think about 200 of them, quite most of the officers and senior officers, captains and majors, there weren't any subalterns, and a number of NCOs, but about 200 of them volunteered to parachute. And as a block, they went through Ringway. And so there they were at Lark Hill, and I came in as the first outside officer from a Yorkshire battalion. And I found that there was no rifle companies formed at all. No, a headquarter company and support company were pretty well established, but there were no A company, B company, or C company. And I was the first officer in, and I was told, right, when the next draft comes in from Ringway, you'll command it and become number one platoon commander of A company. And the next draft will be two platoon of A company. Next draft, three platoon of A company, and then B company will form, and then C company will form. And I found that the chaps that I had were really first class. They had all gone through through Hardwick and Ringway, but so many of them weren't infantrymen. They were from anti-tank regiment or your armoured unit or the RASC, and that we had to start from scratch to train these chaps to be infantry soldiers. Personal training of camouflaging, crawling, going over obstacles, how to get over a barbed wire fence. We had to start from scratch, basic training in infantry, and then there was platoon, section training, Bren group and rifle group.